Okay, go.
Today is the 18th of May, 2020, and we're here in the midst of quite a heat wave here. It's supposed to be 38 degrees centigrade today. Frankly, I don't remember the last time we had such heat. I remember William Kippur was 37 degrees. That was quite a few years ago. But Be'ezrat Hashem Nitgaber. I want to say hello to all my wonderful students in front of me and to all those listening across the wide expanse of Jewish existence. Following up on yesterday, what Jack asked me about the kippah, so I just want to add, the Mishnah Berurah quotes the Mashal, and it's the Mashal that the Yekis are somach on, that in the house where there's a roof, it's not that great a requirement to wear a head covering. Outside, there the Mashal says, perhaps that's the minig lola lechetal ramot beliki sui rosh. I also want to show you something interesting, that the Aruch HaShulchan, you look into the Aruch HaShulchan, and I'm quoting from Siman Bet, and he talks about a sol alechad al ramot bekomis kufa, and then he goes sefkat yud, talks about the importance of the kippah, quotes the gemaras, and he does say at the end uva makom hahechrech kemobar kaot hakira shemidina demalchuta ein laylech bekisui arosh b'sham. So you see, the Aruch HaShulchan is saying very simply that it's not the end of the world, but in modern times it has become a very important identity symbol. He talks about the courts under the Tsar. I remember growing up, if you were to walk into a public library, you took your kippah off immediately. And then nowadays, you go into a public library in Borough Park or Flatbush, I don't think there's a person in the world, there are men and women, without their heads covered, either kippah or kisui rosh. So we've come a long way, but I believe that's summing it up correctly. In Israel today, I doubt very much whether you'll see a shopkeeper without a kippah, like I saw all the time back in the 60s into the 70s. I also want to mention that the story of the Rav in 76, I believe it was, it's very important that the two marks who were both eyewitnesses and ear witnesses should write it up and it should circulate. It's important because 50 years from now, people are going to work on a definitive biography of the Rav, and they have to understand why the Rav was upset that morning, what happened then, the way Mark Licht tells the story, and he was not the one who carried over the scroll, the klaf, but don't get so serious, 44 years ago, we're not going to be able to undo what happened, but someone carried over the scroll, but you can put in a footnote that Aaron Rakefet understands how the Rav felt. It's my own theory that when he saw them coming in with a klaf, he figured, oh, they, it's going to be the real Kibbutz Adat, the Torah of the Avodah, etc., a type of minyan. But it's important that future generations should know that it was not anti-Zionism or anti-Mizrahi. It was the briskest sense of what one can do halachically, what can do with davening. It has to make halachic sense. Okay, but it's very important, Mark Licht and Mark Weiner, if the Ribbono Shel Olam privileged you to be there, you should write it up and let it circulate. I want to make one more comment. I was shaken up, and I again ask everyone to look at the website, the commentator. You have by Rabbi Dr. Michael Broyd, an analysis of YU's tremendous problem. And like everything else, we've gotten lost with Corona. In Israel, we're starting to come out of it. If you want proof that we're starting to come out of it, our politicians are fighting with each other. If you heard the news this morning, last night, to my humble opinion, sub-level idiots that we came down too strict, that Netanyahu listened to Bar Simon, and it really, we shouldn't have closed everything down. No, we should be like America, hitting 90,000 deaths. And because the economy is going down, open it up and let a quarter of a million die. God have mercy, how stupid some of our politicians are. But that's already a good sign that we're past the apex of the plague. So Professor Broyd says very correctly, very soon YU has to go back to that terrible problem of the homos, lesbians, etc. And he analyzes it. The article is worth reading, his suggestions. But what's amazing to me that everyone talks about this problem and no one knows the first man to touch upon it. Where does it all begin? I'm holding up the fourth edition of Bernard Revel. If you open up, and I hope you all have this volume, you open up to page 80. There it is. When Rabbi Revel declared the $5 million building campaign in the 1920s, so he hired a Lushing Yeshiva graduate who had quite Americanized. He already spoke English well and wrote English well at Nishna Geretten Getracht in Yiddish, someone named Harris Selleck. Harris must be Chaim, but Americanized Harris sounds already, when you want to raise $5 million, it's not Chaim who can raise it, it's Harris who can raise it. And in the campaign to raise the money, he declares, this is quoting Zelig, practically every great college and university in America was founded originally as a religious seminary. Princeton was established as a Presbyterian, Harvard as a Congregationalist, and Brown as a Baptist seminary. Our yeshiva college too springs from what was originally a rabbinical seminary. And is it too much to expect that in time, it too, like other great American institutions, will be one of the foremost colleges in this country, its doors wide open to everyone, whatever his race or creed. The unbiased pursuit of knowledge and the truth by scholars being the open sesame to its doors. Rabbi Revel was hysterical in his reaction to this. And there you have it. This is exactly the forerunner of the famous talk that Professor Broad quotes. The ghost, when the Rav speaks about the ghost of Princeton, Harvard, Yale, etc., and he sees it happening to Yeshiva University. This all took place back in 1970. And today, 50 years later, the problem is real, the problem is tangible, and the problem may be insoluble. And I'll let you in on a little secret. Before Corona broke and while you were still sending people here, so there was one week where both Reb Heschel Shechter and Reb Meir Twersky were here. And I met with them, with Reb Heschel, and of course we have a relationship going back to childhood. Reb Meir Twersky I know as well, obviously. And they frightened me. They were talking about what just happened with the lesbians, homos, with the complaining against yeshiva, filing an official complaint. And they told me the only solution will be to totally separate the yeshiva, and it's a separate institution. The university will be a university like Brandeis, and the yeshiva will be separate. And I tell you, I walked away and I said to myself, they're too extreme, this can't be. I mean, that's the, what do we need a yeshiva university for? Go to Columbia, go to Princeton, go to Yale, and learn in a Beit Medrash in the morning, Einein Baya. And I was overwhelmed, and I said, no, this can't be. When I read Professor Broad's article, wow, I am shaking. They're not overstating the case. All right, you're welcome to read it, Nechyeh V'Nireh. But I have to say, there's Harry Selig and there's Rabbi Revel almost 100 years ago, and the ghosts are very much alive right at this moment. Herbie Refuah Shleima, and everything should be well. Okay, now let me roll. We're coming back, we're dealing with the history of the Rabbinical Council, we're dealing with the Halachic Commission, and we're dealing with the period where the Rav takes over. And you'll see when I say takes over, write it with a capital T. We'll explain ourselves in a few minutes, but just to reiterate, the problems were coming the Rav's way. You already see squealing or snitching on a communist sympathizer. I can tell you, if we were to snitch on communist sympathizers, hundreds of thousands of young Jewish people, men and women out of the 30s and 40s, would wind up in jail. 99% outgrew it. There were actually cases of American Jews who went back to Russia, to live in Russia. There were a few famous cases from Chicago, from New York. Later, their own children became refuseniks, wanted to get out. The communist dream exploded in their faces. But we Jews, we look for a panacea, we look for a messianic period. And to many Jews, the communist ideology was socialist messianicism, if I can call it that. All right, the Rav was very much against squealing, and he made that comment which always rings in my ears: Goyim do not know the concept of tshuva. There's a concept of tshuva. A person could have believed in communism in the 30s, the 40s, and by the 50s and 60s, he's a good capitalist like every other middle-class American Jew. The question of the synagogue, Young Israel, that's a fascinating question. And by the way, I mentioned to you that Reb Moshe deals with it with a St. Louis, very similar issue, and Reb Moshe rules like the Rav, that me'ikar hadin, you cannot go and daven in a place that's a ballroom with mixed dancing, with entertainment, off-color jokes, Bob Hope. I don't know if you're aware that in World War II, Bob Hope is remembered today as the great Bob Hope, who risked his life and traveled all over the world to entertain the troops. And he deserves credit. He entertained hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands of troops all over where our forces were stretched out in Europe and beyond Europe and ready to take on Japan. On the other hand, they had a tremendous problem with him. Half his material were off-color jokes. And off-color jokes, you can't tell to soldiers that are stationed endless miles away from their wives, their girlfriends, etc. I need not elaborate. And there was a big critique against him. The Catholic Church in America, his wife was a devout Catholic, Deborah Reed. But he himself, they wanted to take him off the air. So Reb Moshe and the Rav both ruled the same way, that if it's a ballroom and it's a movie theater, it's not a place where you can daven. But I think both of them realized that America, a ruling like that, could not go very far. And it was Maisim B'chol Yom that chose to go with the Yiddish and ran Rosh Hashanah and Kippur services. All right, but now let us go further. Another question came up, and this question we already discussed a number of years ago with the Rabbis, and not this exact question, but a similar question. And this question came up in the West Coast. And as I mentioned, Cy Dolgin, and I had the privilege of knowing him, there were rabbis in America that their entire being represented the rabbinate and covered her rabbinate. Though I can mention Rabbi Shachman, those of you who knew Rabbi Solomon Shachman. Rabbi Cy Dolgin was a similar personality. And he had a balabas that had a carpet store, and he wants to be open Shabbos. And the Agudat HaRabbanim, whoever, we don't have a name, but he claims that a rabbi from the Agudat HaRabbanim arranged the Shtam Mechira, And all of you know, there were bakeries, I remember in New York, a chaver of mine, he's no longer alive, the Tab the K, I believe it was, Rabbi Safra. So the OK and the OU, whenever they lost the Hechsher, he would wind up taking it over. And they told me their biggest complaint against them was they had these bakeries and owned by Jews, and they worked on Shabbos, everything open, baking, and he did a Shtam Mechira that it was sold to a Gentile partner. There was an incident in Yerushalayim, right near the old city, right beyond King David Hotel. There was a quite a large makolet, grocery shop, and they were open Friday night. They did a lot of business, people from the hotels, etc. And the bakery claimed very simply, I mean, I should say the grocery, that he had a shtam mechira, one of his workers was an Arab, and for Shabbos, the Arab owned the place, not he. All right, so the Rav gets this question from Rabbi Dolgin. And Rabbi Klavan, who now is directing the RCA, tells Rabbi Dolgin that the Rav was hysterical, totally, completely opposed. And he says, the Rav said to him, I know that in Austria and Hungary, they used bill of sales to Gentiles for Shabbos, but I consider this a highly questionable approach to the Shabbat, and it renders it no service whatsoever. And the Rav was totally opposed, and you saw this with Rabbi Gorelick, the same Shaila that the shul inherited a business where he was Rav in Connecticut. And this business functioned 7/24, I believe it was. And it would have made the shul totally solvent financially and independent. Ad kedei kach, they didn't even have to charge membership. And the Rav said, no shtam mechira, and Izzy Klavan croaks the Rav that the Rav went as far to say it would be better if he'd be in there himself, be a Mechalel Shabbos, instead of doing this halachic kunz and selling it to a guy for Shabbos. All right, this is the Rav's opinion. I don't think we have difficulty understanding it. What kind of Shabbat do we want? Could you imagine Borough Park, 13th Avenue, my mother married the Zivik Sheni, Rav Moshe Appelbach. Rav Moshe Appelbach was president, he was a lawyer, born in America, raised in America, totally from. One son got smith with me, one son graduated college with me, David Elliott and Elliott Appelbach. And Morris used to go around on 13th Avenue with Rabbi Felder, I have the name correctly, Rabbi Felder, their cousin to the famous Rabbi Felder from, was it Jack in Toronto, Rabbi Felder? And they would go around pleading with the stores to close on Shabbos. Could you imagine that was 13th Avenue? No, could you imagine 13th Avenue today with every store open and a sign up that Shabbos, it's owned by this non-Jew, by that non-Jew. Where's Shabbos? Where's the public observance? Where's the Kiddush Hashem? How can we tell children in elementary day schools, be Shomer Shabbos, if they see all these legal fictions before their eyes? So the Rav was totally opposed, and this is nothing new. But I'll tell you what happens here. Rabbi Dolgin demanded it in writing. He's out on the coast. He has a balabas. Some of these balabatim on the coast, these I know some of them. I knew some of them. I visited quite often. These are heavyweight guys. These are guys who've made hundreds of millions of dollars. And you little rabbi are going to tell me what to do? They're not stupid. Show it to me in writing. And Izzy Klavan said, the Rav yelled at him, what do I have to put this into writing? It's axiomatic. It's the end of Shabbos. And Dolgin wasn't happy. And three individuals pressed the RCA. Who has the real authority? Is it the halachic commission, which means Mori Urebi Rav Soloveitchik, or is it the executive body of RCA, who ultimately bear the responsibility, the president, the vice president, the elected officials, it sounds like Israel, by the way, the Supreme Court, or the parliament. And you should know, under Rabbi Simcha Levi, the Halakhic Commission could recommend. The executive committee always had the final word. Once the Rav took over, everyone bowed to the Rav. No questions are asked. When a Kohen duchens in the Beis HaMikdash, ein botkin acharav. If he duchened in the Beis HaMikdash, it's a sign, perfect yichus. If he did the avodah in the Beit HaMikdash, I should say, ein botkin acharei hamizbeach. The Rav gave a psak. Who's going to open their mouth? Who's going to say boo? Everyone bowed reverently to Moreinu v'Rabbeinu. But here's what's very interesting. Who are the three Rabbanim who challenged the Rav, challenged this procedure, wanted the executive committee to have the final say? Among the three were Rabbi Dolgin. Let me mention another name, Rabbi Dr. Norman Frimmer. Let me mention another name. I just mentioned him, Rabbi Solomon Schaffman. Does anyone see what these three have in common? None of them were YU Mismachim. Shai Dolgin, Chicago. Norman Frimmer, very famous name, Rabbi Dr. Norman Frimmer, head of B'nai B'rith in America afterwards. He was locked in. He was terrorist, took over that building. What was it, late 60s, if my memory is correct? He was held hostage. He was the Talmud of Rav Chaim Zinman. He's the Talmud who relates the story I've often told, where during the, and you have to have known Rav Chaim Zimmerman to fully appreciate this. During the 9 days, Chaim meets him and says to him, "Normie, I gotta have a corned beef sandwich." And Norman says to his Rebbe, "Rebbe, but it's the 9 days." So Chaim says, "Don't worry, meet me tonight at the deli at 8 o'clock. This was about 9 o'clock in the morning, I guess, in Skokie, what they call Skokie today, Hebrew Theological College, HTC. And Norman Frimmer walks in at 8 o'clock, and there's Reb Chaim sitting there with a Baba Batra, calls over a few other people, makes a siyum, and he celebrates the siyum with a good comfort sandwich. And the Norman Frimmer asks him, "Rebbe, when did you begin studying Baba Batra?" He says, "Oh, about an hour after we spoke to each other this morning." So that tells you who Rav Chaim Zimmerman was, Zichrono Livracha. So this is Normie Frimmer. Where's Rabbi Solomon Schaffman from? Vic, you had to know him from Flatbush. He left before you got there, came in Aliyah. Rabbi Schaffman was a product of Chafetz Chaim. Remember the yeshiva in Queens, originally in Brooklyn, Yeshivat Rabbeinu Yisrael Meir HaKotel, popularly called Yeshivat Chafetz Chaim, Rav David Leibovich. We'll talk about it one day when we talk about Torah V'Das B'ez Rav Hashem. It's a breakaway. But he too was not a YU product. And you see, this reflects in their attitude towards the Rav. Izzy Klavan and the other individuals in RCA, they were YU Talmidim. At that time, they were either Talmidim of Rav Moshe Soloveitchik or the Rav. Let's say they were Talmidim of Rav Moshe Soloveitchik. They sat in Rav Moshe Soloveitchik's class for how many years? Every other day, Rav Moshe would quote, "Mein Zun de Gon, my son de Gon, my son de Gon." Gadol mirabim shemei. Oh my gosh. And all right. And even if they sat there cynically thinking, all right, a father's boasting about his son. But when the Rav arrived in America and opened up his mouth, I heard this from eye-ear witnesses who were there. They said to me, they went down to the pier, the Rav is coming, mein Zunder gone. They see this clean-shaven guy, and Jack, by the way, on the boat, when they saw the Rav on the boat and they waved, he was without a yarmulke, without a hat. He was coming from Germany. Heard this from Rabbi Dr. Melech Schachter, eyewitness, and his father went like this to him, that this is America. Put on a hood, you put a hat on here. And the Rav came, they said, then they announced the Rav is giving a shin yeshiva, who's on a service to make shuva, gave him kudshim. And all these cynics, as students can be, went in to hear the shir, and Jay, they walked out, crawling on the floor with Derech Eretz. Get it? So even if they weren't Talmid of the Rav, but just Rav Moshe, but you got to know the Rav. Oh boy, the Rav said he's opposed to Shtam Mechira, legal fiction, for Shabbos. Genug, you don't put it into writing. You quote the Rav. It was interesting. And this machloket, you should know, came up time after time. Louis Bernstein documents it. Ultimately, the problem resolved itself because even the outsiders, even Cy Dolgin, even Solomon Schaffman, Jack, I can't see what you're holding up. If you're holding up something, I can't see it. It's not clear. It's not holding up a Shiloh, but okay. All these individuals got to know the Rav. His word became golden, absolute. All right. We have arrived, and here there's an entire background that I have to be very brief with. I've spoken about it over the years. With all due respects to modern technology, we're not succeeding. I've spoken about this many times over the years. I gave shiurim on this in my Sunday class about 40 years ago, very detailed shiurim. Part of modern mentality is very simple. We can solve every problem. Charlie, you went to Harvard, Mandachar Shmei. What did you get out of Harvard? So they asked the Baron Lichtenstein. So the Baron answered, I learned that life is complex. I always answer when I went to college, university, and I went not to Harvard, not to Yale, not to George Washington, but all right, Yeshiva University. But we had some mighty fine teachers. And unlike the yeshiva, they always inculcated within you a feeling, the world is yours to conquer. We can solve every problem. It's only a matter of time. And you come from Weizmann Institute, you come from the Technion. I see my grandchildren and everyone getting a doctorate in their research and what they're doing. And yeah, either we've solved it or we're going to solve it or we have to solve it. And this is what university is about. To me, that's a very, very important message. I think it plays a big role with Corona and all of life's vicissitudes. The more we can solve, the greater we are. And by the way, this is within the halachic context. Those of you familiar with Ish Halacha, the Rav's magnificent words, Milu et ha'aretz v'kibshuha, rapeh yirapeh. I don't have to elaborate. I'm sure you're familiar with it. This is the human challenge. God made the world for us to finish. And by the way, with a Brit Milah, you have that all the time. That's the chinuch. Why did God let the infant be born unfinished? To teach him that just as he finishes the work on his body, he has to go further spiritually and physically, etc. Why does a woman have a Brit Milah? Very interesting question. The Gemara asks it in Sanhedrin, the Chabet, looking in, you'll see the answer. It's a powerful lecture that I gave many years ago. But this is a little bit different than yeshiva training. What do we learn in yeshiva, shas, and poskim? get involved with philosophy, get involved with theology, that man is limited in his abilities. There's man's initiative, but there's the Ribbono Shel Olam's hashgacha pratit, the Ribbono Shel Olam's will. There's tohu uvohu left in the world, physically, spiritually. We can't always solve everything. And as the Rav said, with that question of the Kohen and the Gioret, I did everything possible. The minute my grandfather said Rav Chaim had many kulot, but where he couldn't solve it, he had to walk away. He had to say, Ad kan, there's nothing more I can do. Or like we said yesterday, I intuitively feel I would like to be Mekil, Paskin this way, but we have to be able to support it halachically. And this is a big difference between a university concept to a yeshiva concept. Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein, I've seen it differently. He always said, I learned the world is more complex. I always wondered, I don't know, I would say if I went to Harvard and was exposed to that whole environment, that the world is complex, I know from the time I was 11, 12 years old. But could be Rabbi Aaron was more sheltered than my upbringing. That's very possible. Knowing his parents, it's very possible. But conquer, up to you. Okay. Now, why am I giving you this introduction? It's very simple. When you come to the United States, you are influenced by a world that seemingly has no end. Give us your homeless, the Statue of Liberty, what Jews were running away from, the pogroms, the massacres, and what a country America is. The Rav used to be Mitpael, and some of you know I'm not making this up. I can still hear it ringing in my ears. Henry Kissinger, Secretary of State. Know how many times the Rav mentioned, and with his German accent, you know the way Kissinger speaks English. I wouldn't exactly say it's the Queen's English, and I wouldn't exactly say it's the Bronx English that we heard in Yankee Stadium. It's English with a very definite German accent. And the Rav once said about Henry Kissinger, I heard this with my own ears, I wouldn't say it, but my Rebbe said it, that since Yosef HaTzadik was viceroy of Egypt, no Jew attained such a prominent position like Henry Kissinger. And this is America. The skies are unlimited. Harry Fishel arrives with $2 in his pocket and later gives away tens and tens of pays money, billions of dollars to Tzedakah. This is America. All right. Willy-nilly, this is translated to halacha. There isn't a problem we shouldn't be able to solve. The more you Americanize, the more you're influenced by this thinking. And now you come to JTS. How did the Jewish Theological Seminary begin? It began as a counter-reaction to the Reform, to the Treif Dinner. We've spoken about this many times in Cincinnati. In the 1880s, they celebrate their first graduation, and it is a Treif Dinner in Essex House Hotel. The first course served is shrimp cocktail. Wow. JTS begins, read the charter, and it's supposed to be a strictly traditional institution in consonance with Torah Shebichtav and Torah Shebaalpeh. As the years move on, and particularly the Solomon Schechter era, they no longer speak Yiddish. The classes are in English. Yiddish is looked down upon. Everyone goes to university. It becomes a beautiful Western American experience. And now you have halachic problems that haunt the rabbinate, and JTS, some of their graduates, take the viewpoint, we have to solve everything. It cannot be that halacha dead ends. We're part of America. We're conquering the world. We succeeded in World War I. We overcame the Depression. Nothing should stand in the way of a JTS graduate. And the greatest problem we have in halacha is the aguna. How did the aguna reflect itself? And these are problems you never think about today. Millions of Jews came to America. Do you know how many people came leaving their wives behind in Europe and never, ever sent a get? They met some woman in America. Either they said they were married, weren't married. It didn't matter. You do whatever you want. Particularly if you know how to learn a little, a man can have two wives. So he has one wife he deserted in Lomsha, in Vilna, and he has another wife that he's rolling and dancing with in the ballrooms in Philadelphia. I know one case, I don't want to mention the name, obviously. I know a well-known rabbi left many descendants, many grandchildren, great-grandchildren, all living in Israel. He went to America, left the wife behind, appeared on a radio show. I don't want to give any more details. Met a lady, but he was a gentleman. He sent the get back to Europe. Dov, are you allowed to do that? It's the get bal kocha. Absolutely not. Chelum de Rabbeinu Geshem. She didn't want a get, but at least he sent the get. She shouldn't remain an aguna. So you see, this was one problem that we had that, all right, time has ameliorated it. Today, as I've told you more than once, and as you read about in the newspapers, the Israeli government has a group of gangsters, mafia, I know some of them, Russian origins. They go all over the world to find husbands who refuse to give a get. L'chatchila, you always want a get, even if there was a civil marriage. This is one problem. There's a second problem, which of course overtakes us in 100,000 different ways. In the 20th century, the Jew had a physical Holocaust and a spiritual Holocaust. In that spiritual Holocaust, we lost millions upon millions of Jews. We lose them daily. I just saw an interview with Chaim Herzog, with Yitzhak Herzog. And he says when he was in America with his father, and the father was the representative to the UN, and he went to Ramaz, and he made friends in America. He says he comes back now, their children are totally intermarried, totally assimilated. And I, the interviewer, should have said to him, Yitzchak, isn't it time you put a kippah on? Don't you realize without observance, there is no future for the Jewish people in the Western world? It's Shabbat, Kashrut, Taret Mishpacha, learning Torah that keeps us Jewish and gives us the ability to rise above the winds of the glorious Western civilization. But the person interviewing him, it's a Haredi publication, they don't ask questions like that. They accept whatever he says. He shows on the wall there's a Ktav Yad of his grandfather. Big deal. Show me in his hands the Ktav Yad that he wrote of the Dvar Hashem Zu Halacha. All right, well, if Halacha doesn't matter, you have thousands upon thousands of cases. Stephen, people married to satisfy their parents, their grandparents. Mark, they get married al pi Halacha. And then who needs a get? Who needs a divorce? Who believes in this stupidity? They walk away, they remarry, they leave their wife. The wife is still a shtickel frum. She was raised properly like Jerry Seinfeld's wife. Jerry wouldn't marry her and she got a get. So this woman wants a get. You want a get? No giti, no washi. The man's not interested. The man doesn't give a hoot. The man may want money. So this problem was a problem that the conservative movement had to deal with. The Orthodox Rabbanim also had to deal with it. The Gedolei Yisrael had to write on this tshuva. But there never was a concept that we can solve all problems. There's a reality, And in the reality, we win most, we lose some. Now, in order to solve these problems, some of the conservative rabbis came up with very far-reaching solutions. The most famous one, and I lectured, must be under 50 years ago, 45 years ago, in great depth, Rabbi Louis Epstein of Brookline of Massachusetts. I believe the name of the shul is Knesset Israel, the name of the temple. Am I right? This is Knesset Israel. It's the big conservative. It was originally an Orthodox shul. They took down the machitza. And Rabbi Epstein was a European Talmud Chacham who came to America at a young age, went to JTS, Americanized, remained the Shomer Mitzvot in his own personal practice. Like all and many conservative rabbis of that period, he believed we'll make a few compromises, get rid of the machitza, we'll keep the people observant. And he came up with an idea. It sounds ludicrous, but it was a very serious idea, very serious proposal. The Sfarim were written, he wrote, others vote against him. Nudi, remember the proposal? The night of the wedding, the Chatan authorizes a divorce. In other words, the very night of the wedding, he signs a Hasha'ah and makes a Kinyan and empowers a Beis Din that they can give a divorce at a certain point in the future if the wife requests it, if he left home for 2 years, whatever, all types of tanayim. But the authorization for divorce is given the night of the wedding. All right, and this proposal was made in the early 30s, a very serious halachic proposal with all types of proper forms. He knew what he was doing. Obviously, it didn't catch on. The Orthodox opposed it, the Agudas HaRabbanim, Cook got involved, others got involved. It's a chapter unto itself. But the proposal simply was too garish, I would say. It was too moribund. I mean, could you imagine the night of the wedding, if someone comes to you and says, this is your happiest night, you're getting married, kol sason v'kol chatan, what a wedding is, sheva brachas. And they come to you and say, sign on the dotted line that whenever you're going to leave your wife or misbehave, you have authorized a divorce, so she should never remain an aguna. That was the famous proposal. It did not carry weight, it did not get off the floor, but it was there, it was widely discussed. Time marches on. You now hit the late 40s, early 50s. For the first time, there's a new type of akana. People are no longer coming to America by the millions. No one is leaving wives behind in Europe to suffer. We survived World War I with agunot. Men who went into the army. We survived World War II with these agunat issues. But now, in the post-World War II boom, there's a new type of aguna, a self-inflicted man-made aguna. You want to get pay up money. And I need not tell you, this is a physical, moral, spiritual offense. Anyone who was raised in the United States, raised in the Western world, with a spirit of fair play, there is nothing worse than this concept. It opens the Pandora box. I heard this from the Rav, by the way, to all the criticisms against Torah. We're unfair to women. We mistreat women, the women are chattel, We buy women, we sell women. You've all heard these expressions. You've all heard these attacks. The man is the only one to give a get. How can you talk like that in a world where men and women are equal and there should be no sexual discrimination? I quote the Rav, Torah Hashem Tamima, but the problems are created by deviant human beings. And this problem came on the scene, and the Rabbinic Assembly, the RA, was ready to resolve the problem. And they were talking in terms of what you hear today on every street corner, and you hear it today more than ever before, because every lay person has access to Shas and Poskim. Harav Hagaon Google is accessible to everyone in the world. And all these computer programs from Bar Ilan on, Hebrew books, etc., etc. Anyone in the world, Shulamit Aloni once got up in the Knesset and quoted so many sources, you thought she was the greatest, most learned Rebbetzin in creation. And today you hear this these two magic words, Hafka'at Kedushin. And how many times have I had to explain and look into Rakhafer Aaron Chelik Dalid, look at all the sources. Yes, there is a concept of retroactive annulment of marriage. We have it a number of times in Shas, five times to be exact. But it's limited in its applications. It's not a panacea, a cure-all. It's not a Salk vaccine or a Sabin vaccine or the vaccine that Be'ezrat Hashem will soon have to fight Corona. And the Rabbanim, I should say the rabbis, not the Rabbanim, the rabbis in the RA, who had all learned a little, 50 to 60% of them were Yeshiva College graduates. The Yeshiva College was the biggest feeder of candidates for the rabbinate in JTS. Another 10% were Torah Vadas graduates, Chaim Berlin graduates. Big feeders for JTS will come to this. Show your sources. We'll talk about Rabbi Tenenbaum, not yet. And these people once learned Masechet Gittin, Masechet Yevamot perhaps, Masechet Baba Batra. This is where you have cases of Hafkat Kedushin. And they're yelling, shouting, Hafkat Kedushin. All right, let's cut off here. 1950, problems, Hafkat Kedushin, conservative rabbis, JTS, the student body, the type of graduates, Rabbinical Assembly at that moment in time. Now, the other side of the coin. The faculty at JTS was always orthoprax. It was not always completely orthodox. On a practical level, every last person was a Shemesh Shabbos 100%. Even Mordechai Kaplan, as you all know, who was the greatest exception, and those of you that have heard my lectures over the decades, if not for Mordechai Kaplan, it would have been in a totally different world. JTS and Yeshiva College would have combined in the late 20s, early 30s, the depression, lack of money. Difference between them was negligible. The yeshiva would have remained Litvish. Postgraduate would have remained scientific. Could have been worked out to everyone's satisfaction. No one knew what to do with Mordechai Kaplan. He was an apikoros, didn't believe in God, didn't believe in Matan Torah, Judaism as a civilization, I wear my handkerchief around my neck on Shabbat. That's what my parents did. Or what a guy named Raquel had heard from Mordechai Kaplan with his own ears. Mordechai Kaplan showed him his fringes. And he says, you see, these are my fringes. I also wear fringes. I said, yes, but there's a big difference between us. I wear them because it's the Dvar Hashem, and you wear them because it's the Jewish civilization. Charlie, he loved it. When I gave him that answer, he loved it. That, oh, you read my book? I said, yes, I read your book, The Jewish Civilization. I know your viewpoint. He was, Morty, like in graduate school, when I handed in my thesis, I'm defending it. So Professor Mirsky looks at my bibliography. He sees I quote his writings. Ah, his face lit up. Baruch Hashem, this guy's worthy of a doctorate. He quotes my writings. But with all the problems of Mordechai Kaplan, the faculty survived him. He was gone. This is the late 50s, this is late 40s, early 50s. He's a figurehead. No one is kowtowing and bowing to him. There's a whole renaissance following World War II. And a lot of Europeans have come in and they're going to the seminary, people from Hungary, from Germany, etc. They were exposed to scientific approach. And not only that, the seminary picked up perhaps the greatest Talmud Chacham in the world from the point of view of the Kiyot, and that's Professor Shaul Lieberman. You can argue from today to tomorrow, was Liebman correct in going to the seminary? And I get very upset when I hear people arguing, because I tell them, you don't know what poverty is. Rumor has it that his first wife, who was the Minsker Gödel's granddaughter, died because there was no money to go to a doctor when she took ill in Israel. It was some point in the 20s, died young. Poverty is poverty. Again, I told you this many times. I was offered the big money conservative shtetl. I turned it down. I'm not one to say I'm a bad example. I'm a good example. But I don't want to criticize Professor Lieberman. All right, he came to the seminary against his father-in-law's will, Rav Meir Berlin. And he always remained a frum Jew, orthoprax and orthodox 100%. You have on the faculty the dominant figure, the chancellor, the president, Professor Louis Finkelstein. Louis Finkelstein's father was a Europeisher Rav in Brooklyn, Rav Shimon Finkelstein, a Shema Mitzvah, 1,000%. Louis Finkelstein, he has descendants totally from 100% living in Israel. He was a Shema Mitzvah 100%, but he was part of that generation. If you'll allow some slight compromise, the people will remain good Jews. It was a tragic mistake, but that's what they thought. You had Professor Avram Yoshua Heschel on the seminary faculty. We spoke about him many times. He and Louis Finkelstein were gasoline and fire. He and, I should say, Professor Shaul Lieberman. Professor Lieberman was kulo halacha, and he viewed Professor Heschel as an Amoritz Theorita, only Machshava, emotion, Hasidus. And Professor Heschel, of course, who had emotion in Hasidus, viewed the Litvakin as dried out fruit. But I can tell you about Professor Heschel, his cousin, who is married to my dear friend, Ellie Marcus, Rabbi Marcus, Zichrono Livracha. Chaya Heschel, my wife's classmate, I believe, or a year ahead of her in Ramans, the Meshbetz Rebbe's daughter, she said about her cousin, Professor Avram Yoshua Heschel, at Nishcha felt the mincha. He never missed up in the mincha. All right, he was a character, went without a kippah, spoke in public, and then very dramatically, when he would drink water in public, put a kippah on and make a bracha, It was a major sight to see. But you see, the faculty, and I can go, Alexander Marx, Louis Ginsberg, who by this point in life had come back to be both orthodox and orthoprax. In his youth, he with biblical criticism, he went over the border, but later on he regretted it. And you had a faculty, no question about it, a minyan at the seminary with a mechitza, with men and women separate 100%. You had a chasm, a duality. There were two different points of view in the seminary. The students were Americans. Innovate. Forget about Yiddish. Forget about Europe. Chas v'chalila, women should remain chained because of ancient laws that had no validity today. And you had a faculty that said, Davar Hashem zu halacha. We may have made certain adjustments that we hoped would keep the people from. But please, we can't transgress any further. We must keep the core. Do not throw the baby out with the bathwater. If you want the greatest proof that my analysis is 100% correct, come into my time machine. Nachum, Lamb, sit, come to my office. I have a special chair you sit in. You say to the Ribbono Shel Olam, 1948. And the machine rattles, you're back in 48. Now you say, take me to 122nd Street and Broadway. You're in the seminary. That Hanukkah, I think it's either 47 or 48. You can check it out. That Hanukkah, the rabbinical assembly, these are the rabbis in the field. Their committee on law has just voted one, the majority opinion, you can use electricity on the Sabbath. Electricity can't be forbidden. It didn't exist when Moshe Rabbeinu came down Har Sinai. If it didn't exist at that time, then it can't be. It needs to be a writer. All right, maybe it's a derabbanan, but there are many factors involved. It's psikreshe, the lo nichole, it's melach hashen, it's richa legufa. We can put together many snifim, and for oneg Shabbos, you need lights. You have to enjoy the world. You can't sit the gates on mother. They permitted electricity on Shabbos. That Hanukkah, president or chancellor by that time, Louis Finkelstein, gave gifts to the students from JTS. What were the gifts? Time clocks for their rooms in the dormitory. Have you heard me correctly? Time clocks for their rooms in the dormitory. Zelichud, bezelichud. Rabbinic assembly, rabbis in the field, students in JTS, faculty steeped in Torah tradition, perhaps the greatest bucky in the world, gracing the faculty, first cousin of the Chazon Ish. When they corresponded, the Chazon Ish would ask Rav Shaul Lieberman questions and not vice versa. Wow. Two worlds. Okay. With me? One step further. There's another factor which also affects JTS. It actually affects all of us at this moment in time in the United States. If you read Odd Scroll and all that goes with it, you'll get the impression the refugees who came in after World War II or due to World War II changed the entire structure. Correct? But there was a base before. There were three-story buildings. Go back to Rabbi Revel H. Chaim. I'll agree, the World War II people enabled us to build 20-story buildings. This crowd affected and touched everyone's heart. How do you think Professor Lieberman, Rabbi Finkelstein, Rabbi Heschel, Dr. Alexander Marx, who only happened to be the Melamed Lahoyer of David Zvi Hoffman's son-in-law, how do you think they felt? Rabban Cutler is now in America. Rabbi Moshe Feinstein is now in America. The Lubavitcher Rebbe is now in America. Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky is now in America. Rabbi Reuven Gazovsky is now in America. Rabbi Avram Yafin is now in America. The Telzer Rosh Yeshiva, Rabbi Bloch, Rabbi Matu Katz, Rabbi Rudem in Baltimore. How do you think they felt? They had a connection. They were inspired. This was Professor Liebman's where he come from, if not Slobodka. Professor Shraga Edmondson, we left out his name. He taught at the seminary. He was a gone idea at Tzadik Yisod Olam. His own son-in-law is a graduate of Grus Kollel. These people, there was a deep connection. You don't want to affront Gedolei Yisrael. You don't want to slap their faces. You don't want to push them aside. You don't want to say to them, you're a bunch of dummies who don't know the depth of what Torah can do. They stood in awe of these people. The students, the rabbinic assembly, who are they? Old-fashioned people from Europe. People who don't speak English properly. People who don't know the American environment. People who don't appreciate the New York Yankees, the Brooklyn Dodgers, or the New York Giants, for that matter. We don't give credit to the Giants. I told you, one time they fielded a starting lineup. 4 out of 9 were Jewish. The pitcher, the catcher, a second baseman, and an outfielder. 4 out of 9 were Jewish. And you know what Solomon Schechter said at one of the early seminary graduations? If the rabbi doesn't know baseball in America, he can't succeed. No, the students took it seriously. You'll ask Reb Moshe, who's on first? He'll look at you. They could do the Stooge Act, who's on first? Who's on first? Remember, am I right? It was the Stooges, or I have it wrong. You can correct me. My dear students, this was a fascinating moment in time. And the students, the rabbis, were yelling and shouting, Hafkat Kedushin. We can solve all problems. Give a woman back her dignity. Open Gemaras. We're not reform. We're just taking Gemaras and applying them. And the faculty was frightened. This is the end. This is shattering. This is breaking our relationship with the rest of the Torah world. We are conservative Jews, but our role is to conserve Judaism, not to break with tradition. Tradition and change, yes, but not totally altering, negating, abrogating, nullifying tradition. And the faculty pleaded with them, calm down, don't go so far, we have a better suggestion. What's the suggestion? A new addendum to the ketuvah that will solve all problems. And that's how the conservative Ketuvah is born, or called more correctly, the Lieberman clause added to the traditional Ketuvah. Now, I just want to tell you, what I've said until now, you're sitting there and listening and saying it's very nice theory, makes sense. Maybe the Rebbe's right, maybe the Rebbe's wrong. I will prove every word I said with sources, but not yet. Let it hold over for next week, the week afterwards. I want to work in an organized fashion. But every thought I expressed, I will back up with a legitimate source. And you'll see that my analysis is 99.99% correct. Okay. Mark, can I ask you a favor? Can you bring me a cup of soda? I don't have, I apologize, I don't have my
which
granddaughter here.
Want? Which one do you want?
The open soda. Just let me resuscitate my vocal cords. With the heat, it's an ongoing battle, and the air conditioning I hold to be an enemy to the human race, but what can I say? Now, let's pick up. Let's pick up with the new Ketuvah. The faculty went out. The student body and the rabbis in the field backed off. For the time being, Havkat Kedushin was pushed aside. By about 1953-1954, the new Ketuvah, the addendum, was made public. Thank you, honey. A lot was written about the new Ketuvah, and I'll begin with the so-called Orthodox point of view, Torah point of view, and there were two major articles that appeared. One article was written by A. Leo Levin, and I'll tell you exactly who he was. His sidekick, Professor Meir Kramer. It was published by Yeshiva University in 1955. New Provisions in the Ketuvah, by A. Leo Landman and Meir Kramer. I knew both of them very, very well. A. Leo Landman and Meir Kramer were two of the most brilliant minds in the legal world. A. Leo Levin was the most famous professor of law in the U of P. He wrote the textbook for evidence, if I'm not mistaken. He wrote one of the basic textbooks that guides all legal jurisprudence until today. Meir Kramer and A. Leo Levin was the son of the rabbi of Trenton, Rabbi Yisachar Levin. He was a Yeshiva College graduate. I don't believe he ever got smicha. He went on to graduate school, remained a frum Jew, a total frum Jew all his life. Anyone from Pennsylvania will remember the name. He was revered. A. Leo Levin. A. period Leo Levin. Imagine it was Abraham Leo Levin. Meir Kramer was a YU graduate, a yeshiva graduate, a musmach of the yeshiva. We're going to talk about his son in years to come, Daniel Kramer, and his doctorate on Torah Mesorah. And I knew his son quite well, although he was a bit younger. Meir Kramer was a rabbi in Philadelphia, and he studied law as well, went on to become a professor at the University of Pennsylvania. And they did a brilliant piece that was published by Yeshiva University right after the Ketuvah was made public, the addendum, I should say. was made public. And their work is very simple. It deals with pure American legal precedent in relation to church and state. And they show conclusively that there was no way the Lieberman provision would muster, would pass, would succeed in the secular courts. In order to get involved, it has religious language. Ultimately, no court, certainly a lower court, perhaps they're influenced by local politics, but once you get to appeals in the higher courts and ultimately the Supreme Court, there is no way the provision can be upheld. And this is what YU published, and I remember distinctly it made a big impression on everyone that in theory perhaps they were right, but halacha lemaisa, it will have no gainsay. This is a problem that comes up many times. I can tell you that I went to school, I got smicha with certain members of a wonderful family. I smicha with one, graduated college with another, knew the other siblings. And this family owned a big business, a very successful business in the heart of Manhattan. And the founders of this business, all from brothers of Hungarian origins, and they worried who knows what will be with their grandchildren, great-grandchildren. So they drew up a very innovative will that the business must always remain Shemesh Shabbos. They put it into the charter. And it stated if any of their descendants will become Mechalalei Shabbos, the business must be sold and the money distributed to tzedakah. If the business becomes, I should say, Mechalal Shabbos, it defaults, it goes under, it has to be sold, the court has to take over, and the money has to be distributed to Orthodox Jewish charities. I have to tell you, I saw the document and people commented that it's a beautiful ethical will. As far as having any validity, halacha lemaasa, not a chance in a million that a secular court in the United States will get involved with the business to determine what is Shmiras Shabbos, what isn't Shmiras Shabbos, and sell the business and then get involved which charities to give it to. All right, it was a beautiful document. To the best of my knowledge, I may be wrong. Time marched on. It's now many, many generations, many decades later, and everything this business was doing was taken over by imports from China. Today, it's not already China. It's imports from other countries, Thailand and other third world countries, etc. And the business might have gone out of business, but I can tell you that as far as I know, all the children, grandchildren, all the direct descendants, many of whom I taught, many of whom I know, have remained total Shomrei Shabbos 100%. So this was what YU published, and this is Amy 11, and this is Meir Kramer. Rabbi Dr. President, not yet at that time, Norman Lamb, one of really the great people that I've known in my life. He should only have a refuah shleima. He's not well today. His descendants, many of them are my own personal dear students. Normy Lamb was then the associate rabbi of Jewish Center of New York. I need not tell you, it was one of the most important rabbinical positions. He was associate to Rabbi Dr. Leo Young, and you all remember my lectures on Rabbi Young. He also was teaching at Yeshiva University already, and he was the editor of Tradition. He was climbing the ladder that ultimately would lead him to become the Rosh Yeshiva and president of Yeshiva University, and so much of his scholarship has been published and is being published from manuscript. And you can see this man had an overwhelming amount of knowledge. In one of the very early issues of tradition, he publishes a halachic critique of the new conservative ketubah. Fall 1959, issue, it's the second year of tradition, it's issue number one. Technically speaking, it's fall 1959, issue two, year two, issue one. I want to thank Yosef Mordechai Yomo for helping me. I had the article, but I didn't have the exact date of the tradition issue, and we were able to come up with it through Harav Hagaon Google. Now, this article takes apart the conservative ketubah point by point by point. And it shows that on a practical level, it's not going to succeed. It deals with it halachically, and it shows that halachically, it's very questionable, and there are problems in this ketubah that are not in consonance with the halacha, or I should say, cannot be enforced, cannot take effect due to halachic considerations. All right. Before we go any further, let me end off the class simply reading to you the addendum, the Professor Lieberman addendum to the ketubah. Now, what was the idea? The idea was not to change anything. The idea was to take the original ketubah, which you all know is an Aramaic, and make an addendum to it. And Professor Lieberman wrote a three-paragraph addendum in Hebraic Aramaic in consonance with the language of the ketubah. In addition, he translated the essence of his addendum into one major paragraph, and that became what everyone called the Lieberman Clause or the Lieberman Addendum. People did not think in terms of Aramaic, but it was this English addendum that all the discussion circles upon afterwards. Let me just say one more thought in the name of Professor Lieberman, and he was absolutely right. When this addendum became public, so there were people in our world, in the Torah world, in the Orthodox world, Tom, Dick, and Harry, who shouted, "How can you make an addendum to the ketubah? Holy document, sacred document." And here, Professor Lieberman stated, and correctly so, "Ich will azein yid, I want one Jew to show me that you're not allowed to add or change or alter the Torah." And my dear students, I challenge you to open up the Torah and find the language of the Torah. Mark Lich, you're going to spend many hours looking at the Torah. You will not find one word of the ketubah in the Chamishei Chumshei Torah. All right, you'll open up the Gemara. The Machlokes is the original ketubah, the Sun, the Oraita, the Rabbanan, the formulation of the ketubah took many years. Not just took many years. There are many variations. How many of you have studied Eben Ezra? How many simanim are there in Eben Ezra, which we never study today, of various types of ketubahs and clauses? Go back to Israel in Gathering of the Exiles. No, you go to the rabbinate today. Dov, you're going to be Masada Kedushin, your granddaughter is getting married. All right, you go to the rabbinate, you bring your smicha, you bring a letter, you're reliable, you're responsible. I'll be happy, I'll give you a letter. I used to have a little influence with the Jerusalem rabbinate. All right. Then they'll say to you, which ketuvah do you want? Ashkenaz, Eidat HaMizrach. Eidat HaMizrach divides up into 1, 2, 3. You're supposed to send the ketuvah back with the father of the bride, right? To the Misrata Batar. It has to be registered with the government. So I don't trust anyone. This is very important. I walk back myself to the Misrata Batar to bring back the filled-in ketuvah. So the girl, the secretary, looks at me and she figured for sure I'm the father of the bride. I can't be the rabbi. So I played along with it. I said, you can't, honey, maybe it's any haba. I'm going to stop telling her. I said, a Talmud of mine, it was Masada Kedushin, etc. And then she looks at the ketuvah and her eyes lit up. Oh, harav yada. In most rabbanim don't even know the ketuvahs are so involved. What you have to do here in the government document, and boy, I am an expert on an Ashkenazi ketuvah. That much I will tell you. The Slavic ketuvah, I have no idea. But in Gathering of the Exile, so you're going to criticize Professor Lieberman because he added a paragraph to the ketuvah? Believe me, if that's your criticism, you are an ignoramus to the second power. All right. And let me end off. Here's the lesson. And in Solomon, send to their mutual responsibilities and love. The bridegroom and bride have declared, as evidence of our desire to enable each other to live in accordance with the Jewish law of marriage throughout our lifetime, we, the bride and bridegroom, attach our signatures to this ketuvah and hereby agree to recognize the beiting of the Rabbinical Assembly and the Jewish Theological Summit of America, or its duly appointed representatives, as having authority to counsel us in the light of Jewish tradition, which requires husband and wife to give each other complete love and devotion, and to summon either party at the request of the other in order to enable the party so requesting to live in accordance with the standards of the Jewish law of marriage throughout his or her lifetime. We authorize the Beit Din to impose such terms of compensation as it may see fit for the future, and to respond to its summons and to carry out its decisions. My dear students, a simple paragraph, 3 concepts. 1, we want to live as good Torah Jews in consonance with all that has gone on before us, Torah and tradition. 2, we will go to the basin of JTS and the Rabbinical Assembly. This basin is our authority. 3, whatever the basin tells us, we will do. And if we act up, they can fine us. They can demand compensation from one party to the other. And whatever they want out of us, we will salute, we will jump, we will do. This is the essence of the Lieberman clause, the Lieberman addendum to the ketuvah. This will certainly solve the problem of the man who doesn't want to give a get unless he's paid off. The Beit Din will say to him, you animal, you're a disgrace to human existence. Every day that goes by that you don't give a get, we fine you $1,000 per diem. You have signed this addendum. We will have it enforced by the local secular court. You Oisvach, you Shagets, shape up, because we'll ship you out. Gentlemen, what a document. What an idea. Will it hold up? Is it valid? What is the fault line? All right, the Ribbono Shel Olam should give me strength. Gentlemen, you don't know how much I'm suffering. I'm preparing Shiurim. I'm up in heaven with Torah, Mesorah. Right. Hold on. That fire engine or that's Netanyahu going by? Whenever you hear tapes of the Rav, you hear the fire engines on the Upper East Side. Time and again, you hear it. It has to pause while they go by. So I apologize. It was either Netanyahu going to the Knesset or perhaps it was fire engines. I don't think it was an ambulance. Thank God. I'm preparing Shurim, but I got to finish this. I have to do proper. Finish Shalom. What a topic. What interest. Simple paragraph. Wait till you see what happens. So what did we do today? Baruch Hashem, we finished out I'm tempted to go to my terrace and look and see what's going on. Maybe it's the president who has to swear in the new Knesset. Anything is possible. Okay. So what did we do today? We finished up, all right, Machlokes between the West Coast and the East Coast and the Midwest in relation to the Rav's authority. But that's Pachim Ktanim. The real heart of today's lecture was the background that brought Professor Lieberman to author the addendum, which becomes part of the Ketubah. To be totally historically honest, the idea was not Professor Liebman. It comes from a rabbi in the field. We'll come to him, Max Arts. If you recognize the name, he was the first one to come up with this idea as a compromise between Hapkod Kedushin and something that will not be so offensive to the faculty of the seminary. Professor Liebman, of course, fine-tuned it and brought it to reality. Be'ezrat Hashem, next Sunday we pick up where we left off with eyeglasses on Shabbat, and I'll come back to Saul Berman again, you'll see. But it'd be a fascinating material. And yesterday's shiur where I danced on the roof, I cannot tell you how inspired I am that Jack can no longer laugh at me. He probably figured, Rebbe, you made it up. No one in the world talks about it. And take a look, 1958 to 2020, and I found that Achi Samach. I only hope someone will hit Mayor Lichtenstein and find out where he got it from. I want to trace it back, and I dream maybe the Rav did write a tshuva. Where is it? I have never seen it. No one has ever seen it, as far as I know. Did he write it? Do we have it? If we can come up with it, Mark, you're a businessman. I guarantee you that tshuva you can auction off for $100,000, and I may be understating the case. My dear students, Morty, you want to title it? Title it Background to Conservative Ketuvah. Background to pulling me again in health and happiness. Das Vidanya. Morty, cut me off, put everyone else on, or cut.